All right. Welcome, everybody, to the State Line Church of Christ Sunday morning auditorium Bible class. Today, we are going to be covering the Gospel of Mark. And specifically, we're going to be covering chapters 13 and 14. As always, be ready to answer all my questions this morning. It really helps promote a healthy class. And if you're genuinely trying to learn, as I know that all of you are, there are no bad questions or answers. So, and obviously, if I misspeak at any point on anything in here, I would have you correct me. I would rather have a bruised ego versus saying something incorrect from the Word of God. So like I said, today we are going to attempt to get through Mark chapters 13 and 14. But realistically, we'll probably spend most of our time in Mark 13, considering that it has quite a bit to discuss. There's some apocalyptic language in there that we need to work through. While 14 is definitely more straightforward, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of good stuff in 14, but covering this much in one class will be a challenge. 14 itself has, 72 verses? So, we'll try to keep it moving. But, so, go ahead in your Bibles, turn to Mark chapter 13, and we'll start looking at what we have there. The first thing I want to discuss with Mark 13 is that it's a popular passage that premillennialists like to actually reference when they're expressing their beliefs, mainly due to the apocalyptic language that we see within it. For example, verses 24 through 27 of 13 have a lot of that language. The abomination of desolation mentioned in verse 14. They also talk about the Battle of Armageddon, which they think maybe in verse 7 is the wars Jesus is talking about there. But first of all, who can maybe explain to me the basic beliefs of premillennialism, just in a bullet point summary? Who would like to maybe give me a summary of that? There are several variations, but that's the general idea. Back when Jesus first came to this earth, as mentioned in the Gospels, he was rejected by man and went back to heaven, essentially defeated. And the current church we have today is some sort of placeholder. And then Jesus will come back and reign for 1,000 years on earth, on David's throne, and then the chosen will be taken up into heaven after a 1,000-year reign. And that's kind of the basis of the premillennialist belief. And these beliefs stem from taking the apocalyptic language we see at face value, essentially. But today, in chapter 13, we're going to see that he's not talking about the things I just listed out. He's more talking about just the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem itself, and then at the end of 13, he's going to be talking about the end of the world. Now, as an aside, the parallel passages for Mark 13 in the other Gospels are going to be Matthew 24 and Luke 21, which we are going to be referencing for some context. Now, the last thing I want to do before jumping into 13 is a little bit of context for what's going on right now. So where were we at the end of Mark 12? What was happening? What was going on? He was confronting the hypocrisy and emptiness of the scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, and then also he made commentary on the widow's offering, right? How she gave all, even though it was little, it was still more than what everyone else was giving. But all of this was taking place inside the temple, I'm pretty sure. And at the start of 13, they are exiting this scene and leaving the temple. So that is where we see things start out at the start of Mark 13. So who would like to read Mark chapter 13, verses 1 through 2 for me? Just verses 1 through 2. In verse 1, we see one of Jesus' disciples point out to him just how magnificent the temple was. And indeed, it was an impressive structure. I believe in John 2:20, it says it took 46 years to build. And just imagining how that amount of time to build something is kind of hard for me to comprehend. I mean, I'm only halfway there in my own life. So having a building be built that entire time, it must be a grand structure indeed. But I want us to think, maybe how had the temple maybe become a reflection of the state of Judaism? And as a hint, remember, Jesus just got finished criticizing the Pharisees for actually not having any substance or being in their emptiness in their religion. So maybe how had the temple become a reflection of that? Instead of being a place of worship, it became a place of business and politicking, right? And that's essentially the exact same parallel we see with the Pharisees and Sadducees. And then in verse 2, we see that Jesus prophesies that the physical temple will be annihilated due to the spiritual abomination it had become. And considering just how massive the temple was, I'm sure that to all who heard him say this, it came as quite a shock. They probably at first were thinking, did I hear him correctly? Did he say that this massive thing that took 46 years to build is going to be destroyed? And then one final thing before moving on, it's important for us to remember to keep the spiritual in proper focus so that we don't become so enamored by the physical. While the physical can still be appreciated and respected, we can obviously see here that even though the temple in all its grandeur, it's still going to be destroyed because, God deemed it so, but also because of the fact it's empty. What's going on in it is not correct. All right, so that was verses 1 through 2. Who would like to read verses 3 through 4? In verse 3, Peter, James, John, and Andrew ask him privately about what he was talking about earlier. And if I had to guess, they probably were thinking on this all day long. Because like I was just saying before, this was quite the claim. This was a massive structure, and it was literally the hub of their entire religion. So in order to make a claim like that, something big and drastic is going to happen, and they want to know more about it. And then in verse 4, we see the questions posed by the apostles, and based off of Mark and then our parallel passages, we can, let's say, split up their questions into four different questions. And I can say this because Mark 13 seems like there's only two there, but Matthew 24:3, and I can read this one, helps us build these questions as well. In Matthew 24:3, it reads, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" So essentially, they're asking four questions here. When will the temple be destroyed? What signs will precede its destruction? What signs will show Christ's coming? And then what signs will show the end of the world? The first three have more to do with just the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And then the last one is a completely different question and answer altogether. And the thing about this is that the disciples probably thought that all of these questions had the same answer. The destruction of the temple probably meant the end of the world, right? I mean, what else could take down such a massive structure? But that's obviously not true because the temple has been destroyed for quite some time now, and we're still here today. Okay, so now we're going to be getting into the meat of this. We need to read verses 5 through 23. And actually, before we read it, let me just say that we see here in verses 5 through 23 that Jesus answers the first two questions, that being, when will the temple be destroyed and what signs will show or will precede its destruction? So in verses 5 through 23, Jesus is going to answer, these are the signs that are going to precede the temple's destruction and Jerusalem's destruction as well. So who would want to read verses 5 through 23? Okay, so in those verses, there are, I believe, seven different signs that we're going to cover that Jesus is letting them know are going to precede the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. The first sign we see is going to be in verses 5 through 6. So what is the first sign that we see here in verses 5 through 6? Yes, so we are going to have many imposter messiahs, right? Many people coming and saying that I am the one. Obviously, that's not true because Jesus is telling them here that I am obviously the one and these people are going to be fake. But it does also say many will be persuaded by these false messiahs. And my next question is, how do you think people could be deceived by these mere men when Jesus is obviously so much better? How do you think these people were getting deceived so easily? And, you know, when people are desperate for hope, they'll latch onto anything, right? And, you know, there's people out there as well who are just great at deceiving people. They're very smooth talkers. I mean, we still have cults today where people follow a certain person because they just appear special and they seem to have all the answers. It happens in Jesus' time and it's still happening today. Okay, so that was sign number one, false imposters. Sign number two, this is going to be in verses 7 through 8. What is the second sign we see in verses 7 through 8? Yes. Once again, it says, and then 8 also says nation will rise against nation. There will be earthquakes and famines, which secular history actually can support this. Obviously, the wars and rumors of wars and nation rising against nation. You have the Roman subjugation during this time. And during when Jerusalem will be destroyed, Rome actually does start making a military conquest to Jerusalem. And then there is also several, I believe, Gentile uprisings within the Jewish nation. And then I believe it's recorded that there were earthquakes in Crete, Rome, Laodicea, all around the area. And then Roman writers such as Josephus do mention famines during this time as well. So secular history does support this sign. In verse 9, we see sign number 3. Who wants to tell me what sign number 3 is? And I believe here it's specifically saying, yeah, persecution to Christians by Jews and Romans. Excuse me. And it should be, this was interesting when I was looking into it. Judaism had a special exemption from Rome for the longest time, where it could still be practiced underneath the Roman subjugation. And for the longest time, Christianity was overlooked by the Romans because they figured it was just an offshoot of Judaism. Well, Jesus is saying here that's not going to be the case when these things are to come to pass. Christians will be persecuted by Jews and Romans alike just for being Christians. Verse 10, what's the sign we see in verse 10? The gospel will have spread all over the Roman world. And it's interesting, in Colossians, Colossians itself was written in 62-64 AD, which the destruction of Jerusalem happened in 70 AD. And Colossians 1:23 reads, "If indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, became a minister." So we can see here, Paul is saying that the gospel has spread far and wide. So this sign then would have been fulfilled before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, because once again, Colossians was written around 62-64 AD. Verse 11, we see sign number 5. Who wants to say sign number 5 in verse 11? The Holy Spirit will still be active through people. And this is important because that only lasted one generation after the original apostles, right? They were able to pass it on one time. So that kind of gives us the time frame on when all these things should be taking place. Moving right along. Sign number 6 in verses 12 through 13. Verses 12 through 13, sign number 6. Who wants to say it? The sanctity of the Christian family. It's not safe, and there's going to be betrayal within families, and Christians being hated just for being Christians. Once again, we've kind of covered that already in one of the other signs, but it's being listed in another way here that you're not even safe from your own family members during this time, which sounds like a terrible proposition, but I mean, there's times where that certainly can happen. And now, verses 14 through 18 for sign number 7, which is an interesting one, which is where we get a little bit of apocalyptic language. So what's the sign number 7 we see in verses 14 through 18? Well, actually, more specifically, just 14.
The abomination of desolation.
Yep, so sounds big and scary, right? What exactly is that? The abomination of desolation. Sounds like an end of the world thing to me. But that's kind of the case for a lot of apocalyptic language. And we actually get our answer from one of our parallel passages. And Luke defines this abomination of desolation in Luke 21:20. And that says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near." So when Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies, that is the abomination of desolation, which makes sense because this Roman army that comes in and destroys Jerusalem, it's definitely an abomination. They desolate everything, so it certainly lines up. And then in verse 14, what is the action that we see recommended by Jesus? Yes, flee to the mountains. So when you see the Roman armies approaching Jerusalem, because the Romans didn't, like I was saying before, the Romans didn't immediately head for Jerusalem and surround it right away. They made a conquest to Jerusalem along the way. When you see this happening, it's time to go. It's time to get out. It makes no sense to stay. Verse 19. Why did Jesus describe these events as so horrible? Once again, he says, "For in those days there will be such tribulation as has not been from the beginning of the creation that God created until now. It never will be." That's a very dramatic language. Why do you think he used it here? And very powerful language.
Because
I believe it's because it's probably true. The divine judgment from God on his people, it completely annihilated them. Why? Jesus was describing it as such because this was the divine judgment from God on his people. Because they killed Jesus instead of accepting him. And, you know, he uses this language because it destroyed the Jews as a people and as a culture. I mean, the destruction of Jerusalem as described by Josephus is harrowing, to say the least. It was complete and total annihilation. And it not only wiped them out as a people, but even as a culture. I mean, the Jewish people have not even recovered, even until this day. And during that destruction, their lineage records, which were the basis of their whole culture, were completely wiped out and destroyed. So they had no idea who they were anymore. And like I said, that was the basis of their entire culture. So what are you supposed to do with that? So I believe that's why the language was used there the way it was. And then in verse 20, who do you think are the elect mentioned in verse 20? Yes. So this is not talking about anything that premillennialism would try to bring up. Like, there's not some sort of chosen elect beforehand. These are just the Christians that God will provide a means for escape for during the destruction of Jerusalem. Verses 21 through 22. This is just another warning about false prophets. Jesus has already stated once that many will be fooled, but he's just reiterating it. Because it obviously sounds like it's going to be a big issue. So just stay on your guard and know that I am the Messiah and these other people, don't even listen to them. Don't let them persuade you. And then in verse 23, we see some encouragement from Jesus because he's told them what to look out for. And he's confident that his people will be safe. Okay, so that was the seven signs kind of showing what's going to be happening before the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. There's been many attempts throughout history to try to snuff out the church completely, right? But it's never worked. I don't think that's a coincidence, right? Thank you for bringing that up. Okay, so once again, what we just read, 5 through 23, that is the signs that we'll see preceding the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, in verses 24 through 31, we see Jesus answer question 3, which once again was, what signs will show Christ's coming? Now, I believe this is still talking about, and this is kind of where there's a big split. Some people think this is about the end of the world. Some people think about this is the destruction of Jerusalem. I think this is still talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and this is telling of Christ's coming in judgment on Jerusalem. And you're free to think what you will, obviously, and you can let me know what you think in this class, and we can talk about it. But that is what I think that what we're about to read, 24 through 27 especially, and through 31 as well, are still talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, so let's go ahead and read Mark 13, 24 through 31. Obviously, there's once again some apocalyptic language we need to sift through in verses 24 through 27. I believe he kind of shifts back to normal speech in verse 28, but we'll get into that a little bit. So we see in verses 24 and 25 that Jesus is describing God's judgment on Jerusalem in the way a Jew would understand. Once again, it says, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. So what do I mean by the way a Jew would understand? Well, there are many Old Testament passages that actually use similar language. And the one I'm going to read from is going to be Isaiah 13, 9 through 13. In Isaiah 13, 9 through 13, it says, behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with wrath, in fierce anger, to make the land a desolation, and to destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of the heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pomp of the arrogant, and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. I will make people more rare than fine gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken out of its place, at the wrath of the Lord of hosts, in the day of his fierce anger. So, we can see similar language there. There's also some similar language in Ezekiel 32, 7 and 8, Joel 2, 10 and 11. So, even though this language does sound awesome and extravagant, and how could it mean anything else other than the end of the world, It was used also in the Old Testament describing other events, and we're still here, so that wasn't the end of the world either. It's just, like, once again, it was the way that the Jew would understand that, okay, I'm recognizing this language, so this is what's about to take place. And then in verse 26, we see the continuation of this divine judgment, and Jesus is coming to the destruction of Jerusalem. And Daniel actually prophesies this in Daniel 7, 13 through 14. It says, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like the Son of Man. And he came in the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. And the key there is coming in the clouds of heaven. Those are the similar language we see there. And then in verse 27, it says, he'll send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. Once again, I don't think this is supporting premillennialism. This is once again talking about the Christians that will be spared in the oncoming desolation of Jerusalem. And then verses 28 through 29, we see that Jesus aids further by giving the time of year that they should be expecting these things, by giving the lesson of the fig tree. Once again, he says, as soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also when you see these things taking place, these things being the signs we've already talked about, you know that he is near at the very gates, he being the desolation that is going to come on. Okay, and then once again, in verse 30, he says all these things will need to take place in the current generation. And I believe this is actually literal, that it does line up timeline-wise. So why am I taking this literal when I didn't take 24 through 27 as literal, and I know it's apocalyptic language? Well, once again, like I was saying before, Jesus is summarizing here from all that he said, and there is a shift again starting in verse 28 where he stops the apocalyptic language, he dials it back and starts talking more, I guess, for lack of a better term, normally again. And then in verse 31, we see him wrap this all up with saying, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. This is him essentially saying, he's showing his authority and saying, these things will come to pass. I have spoken on this matter. So, once again, all we just covered right here is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And something I want to point out, language-wise, if we look in verse 24, but in those days, right? He's referencing a certain number of days at some point. And I want us to remember that as we go into the next section. But before we do that, does anyone have any comments or anything they want to make on what all we just covered in Mark 13 so far? If not, then we can continue right along. So once again, we've answered three questions so far. When will the destruction of the temple be? What signs will precede it? Well, what signs, or when will Christ come? And now we're answering the final question, which is the end of the world. What signs will show the end of the world? So let's go ahead and finish up Mark 13 with verses 32 through 37. Now we're going to look at, remember I just said, looking at verse 24, but in those days. We see in verse 32, he says, but concerning that day and hour. Notice the plural versus singular here, because the end of the world is going to be the final day, right? It's just going to take one day for the end of the world to happen. So, and also just notice the transition as well with concerning that day or hour. This is a completely different time period altogether. He's talking about something else here. He's not talking about the destruction of Jerusalem or the temple anymore. And this is why I'm saying that these passages concern more the end of the world. And then also something I found extremely interesting was that Jesus doesn't even know when the end of the world will be. Only God the Father does, which I found to be incredibly interesting. And then in verses 33 through 37, we see him giving a warning of being on guard. You don't know when that time will be, so why in the world would you try to risk it with your soul? And I do have a kind of a fun hypothetical for you. Like, how many times when maybe you're trying to do the right thing by yourself and you finally realize, I'm by myself, maybe I can get away with this one thing, But as soon as you start doing what you're not supposed to, someone shows up and you're caught in the act, right? It's almost uncanny how much that happens, right? So why would you do that with your soul, right? You shouldn't risk something that precious. Okay, so that was Mark 13. I know we kind of went through that kind of quickly. Firstly, in verses 1 through 2 of Mark 14, we see that the chief priests and scribes are seeking to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him, but they're scared of the people during the feast, which is referencing the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Would anyone know why would, specifically during the Feast of the Passover and Unleavened Bread, why would it be specifically then that the people would get into an uproar? I believe my answer is Jesus was incredibly popular, obviously. And considering the Passover, maybe the Jews thought that Jesus could deliver them from the Romans, just like they were delivered from the Egyptians long ago. I just know in general that emotions are running very high during the Passover and these feasts. So that is probably the reason why that they thought specifically during these events that they shouldn't do this. Yes. Everyone's coming to Jerusalem as well. It's a big to-do. Verses 3 through 9, we see that Jesus is anointed at Bethany by a woman who uses a very expensive bottle of nard, I believe the phraseology is. And one of the disciples actually criticizes her and says, you could have sold this for 300 denarii and given it to the poor. So a few questions. Does anyone know how much, 300 denarii would be or what that would equate to? It's about a year's worth of work wages, right? So, yeah, a significant sum. And then we don't actually get this from Mark. Let's see, where was it? Yes. But who specifically criticized this woman?
Judas.
Yep. In John 12, 4 through 5, it says, but Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, who was about to betray him, said, why was the ointment not sold for 300 denarii? Okay, keep on going. We see in verses 10 through 11 that Judas, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And then the Passover with the disciples commences, where Jesus tells some of his disciples to go prepare a room. One of the things I wanted to point out here, maybe this could have been miraculous and everything just worked out the way Jesus said because he's Jesus. Or maybe he actually set this up beforehand, considering the fact that they were to meet a man carrying water, which was actually something that you weren't really supposed to see. Carrying water was more of a woman's job in the Jewish society. So a man carrying a water jar like this would have stuck out like a sore thumb. So maybe Jesus arranged all this beforehand to happen. Or maybe it was miraculous. I'm not entirely sure. Verses 22 through 25, we see the institution of the Lord's Supper. Very classic and popular passage. The only thing I'll say here is he says, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Thanks to Jesus' blood, we are no longer bound under the law of God, but instead under the love of God, which is an incredible blessing because no one can uphold the law in the way it was because we are imperfect, not because God made some mistake. Keep it on going. We see in 26 through 31 that Jesus foretells Peter's denial. And he actually says, you will all fall away, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. So he not only foretells Peter's denial, but he also talks about how all of his followers will scatter before him, which must be an incredibly hard thought to know these things beforehand and to still go through with it anyway, which we see coming up in verses 32 through 42, where Jesus prays in Gethsemane, where he goes to Gethsemane and says to his disciples, sit here while I pray. And he took with him Peter, James, and John a little further off, and he began to become greatly distressed and troubled, which is actually an incredibly human emotion, to have that feeling of, oh, this is happening. It just shows that Jesus is just as human as the rest of us. And it can make you emotional for sure. And then we see him pray, and, Jesus, being the perfect Son of God that he is, he still doesn't want to do this. He knows the pain that is about to happen. So he asks God that it remove this cup from me, if he will, but still being the Son of God and as righteous as he was, he says, but if I need to bear this burden, I will. He returns to the apostles, specifically, I believe, Peter, James, and John. They're asleep. And this, once again, lends to maybe his feelings of panic and being alone. And this happens, I think, two more times. They keep on falling asleep. He goes to pray. They keep on falling asleep. And eventually, we see here, he says, "Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand," in verse 42. We then see Judas come up and kiss Jesus, signaling that this is the one you need to come arrest. And then it doesn't say here in Mark who cut off the servant of the high priest's ear, but I believe it was Peter, correct? Yes. Peter cuts off a servant's ear, and then Jesus says to them, "Have you come out against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you do not seize me, but let the scriptures be fulfilled." And they all left him and fled. So Jesus is now alone. 51 through 52 is a weird inclusion. I'm not sure why it's here specifically. At this point, it was getting close for me to actually head back over here to give the class, so I didn't look at this passage too much. But a young man followed Jesus in nothing but a linen cloth, but they seized him, but he got away with nothing left on him. Continuing on, Jesus is then put before the council of the high priests, and Peter followed at a distance right into the courtyard. And he was sitting with the guards, warming himself with the fire. And then the chief priests and the whole council were seeking to find testimony against Jesus so that they could condemn him. Well, the funny thing is, they couldn't get anything to line up correctly. Everything they tried didn't work. So eventually, the high priest just flat out asks him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" in verse 61. And Jesus says, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power, coming with the clouds of heaven." Excuse me. And the high priest tore his garments and said, "What further witness do we need?" So this is blasphemy to them, I guess, because this guy is obviously not the Son of God. The Son of God is going to lead us against Rome, so this guy obviously can't be it. So that was all the proof that they need. And at that moment, he's condemned, and they start spitting on him and beating him up and shouting at him to prophesy. And then finally, we see in verses 66 through 72, Peter denies Jesus. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came. And seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, "You also were with the Nazarene Jesus." But he denied it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you mean." He went out into the gateway, and the rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him and began again to say to the bystanders, "This man is one of them." But again he denied it. And after a little while, the bystanders said to Peter, "Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." But he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I do not know this man of whom you speak." And immediately the rooster crowed a second time. Excuse me. And Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, "Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." And he broke down and wept. It's an important lesson here that we see from Peter denying Jesus, that you need to make sure within yourself, and you need to run through these scenarios in your head, that if it comes down to it, am I going to be willing to say, yes, I'm with Jesus in this situation? Because more than likely, with the other Roman soldiers being there, they were going to throw me right next to Jesus as well, right? And you need to, in your mind, be thinking, I need to be ready for that. Peter obviously thought he was. Earlier on, he kept on saying, "I'll die for you." When it comes down to it, when it's actually put to the test, he buckles. Now, once again, we know that Peter, for all his faults, he still leads a very successful life as being an apostle of Jesus, or a disciple of Jesus. And it can be the same for us. No matter how much we stumble, remember that you can pick yourself back up and try to be the person that God knows you can be. I believe that is all the time I have. So that was Mark 13 and 14. If you have any questions for me afterwards, make sure to let me know. But thank you all for your time.